At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Welcome to New Books in South Asian Studies, hosted by Tara Anjaria out of Bombay, India. Last week was all about the ruling elite and the settings they created and lived in. Today we bring you a post from the periphery, Northeast India to be exact. Before we get down to the interview, a few words about what is called Northeast India. This means, in the parlance of the Republic of India, the states of Assam, Arunachal Pradesh, Mizoram, Meghalaya, Manipur, Nagaland, Tripura, with the former kingdom of Sikkim often included as well, sprawling over 260,000 square kilometers with a population of over 39 million, speaking over 400 languages and dialects. Literacy rates here are some of the highest in India. The biggest city is Guwahati in Assam. Our guest is Marcus Frank. He will talk to us today about his book, War and Nationalism in South Asia, The Indian State and the Nagas.
Oh, hello.
Hello. Good afternoon, Marcus.
Good afternoon, Dara.
Thank you for doing this for the New Books Network, and it's a pleasure having you on board.
Well, the pleasure is mine, of course.
Well, I think it works both ways, but this is certainly an amazing book, you know, and it's obviously not very common. I mean, you don't have too many people researching, well, Northeast India. So could you just tell us how you came to be interested in the region, I mean, in your academic career leading up to the writing of the book?
Yeah, I started studying anthropology and political science of South Asia and modern Indian languages at the University of Heidelberg at the South Asian Institute there. That was, I started this right from the beginning. And I was always at Heidelberg in the beginning. You could study South Asia and Southeast Asia together. So the Naga Hills, so the area of Northeast India, culturally more Southeast Asian, politically nowadays, South Asian is, when you think about it, a natural choice. And there also my interests between anthropology and political science. So I was in anthropology. I was especially interested in the subdivision of historical anthropology and in politics and in political history and in wars of resistance and so on. So that is why I chose the topic of wars, and then because of the area of the Naga war, or wars, if you consider them as two wars, the British and the Indian War, as topic first for my master thesis. So when I then chose my master thesis, which I back then did in anthropology, I realized that there was and using all or reading all the secondary literature that was available to me, I realized that there was no substantial verb done yet about this war. The only newer literature was propagating rather fashionable theories that somehow either denied the war's there completely or blamed the Nagas for the wars because they were influenced by missionaries or British colonialists. That was the post-colonial constructionist theory that made the victims responsible for their own victimhood. And or the Indian political science writers' prevalent argument that it was irrelevant what was happening at the periphery because the benefits of the center were so big that even if the periphery were under military rule, that was not important at all. So because of all these factors, you know, my first interest in that region, because of it was politically South Asia, it was culturally Southeast Asian, it had certain, let's say, violent conflicts there, and the literature as such was so of such a bad quality, or it's of such a bad quality that one could easily make a difference, or easily, yes, one could easily make a difference, which is, as you know, not always the case in science, in social science. I after my MA thesis, or when working on my MA thesis, I worked as a translator for the International Committee of the Red Cross in Kashmir. And while doing that, I was reading literature on the war there, and there is quite some good books existing about that, as well about Punjab, or when you go to Sri Lanka, there's all the good literature existing, but that is not the case for the Nagas. And that was pretty much when I was then asked to whether I would like to get a scholarship to do a PhD research. I said yes, under the condition that I could choose the Naga war to write about. So that was the principle, that was basically the genesis of how it came about that I wrote about the Nagas.
So could you tell us something about how your research unfolded, I mean your PhD research?
Yeah, that was, for my MA, I already had started to work on theories of state formation, of nationalism, of war, of ethnicity and ethnogenesis, and had read, as I said before, nearly all the secondary sources on the Naga case. So what I then thought is, if I want to find out something new, I have to put that all aside. So I went into the British Library more than a year. I gathered all the material from somewhere else, but mostly inside the British Library, and looked for all the files, the papers, handwritten papers of British officers that could give me some information about the area that nowadays Nagas are living in. So I searched via this, I searched also for new material, which was not mentioned somewhere else, which had not been mentioned before. So, and with that material, with that historical primary material, I built first on more or less uncategorized historical narrative. And this historical narrative, then I started to, I wrote first, I first collected for a year primary material. Then I wrote a rough historical narrative only with this primary material. And then I tried to see what had happened in relation to who was the political agent, or who were the main political agents, and who was then fighting when and why. Because the ultimate aim was also to find out why this fighting was going on, and whether this fighting was always the same fighting, or whether it was a different fight. So, and with that, I start then to categorize this narrative. And when I had done that, I could already see that certain of many of my, or a lot of the data did not fit the conventional history of the Naga. So I could find several new angles. And this data that I embedded into the regional and into more or less global or imperial history. So I have, let's say, three layers of historical narratives, and wherever I had no real explanation, I draw on comparative cases like the headhunting cases, all those famous headhunting cases in the Nile. Just to understand headhunting, one has also to look at other cases somewhere else. And to understand the British conquest, one has to understand the history of the British Empire, obviously. And when one does that, when one compares the different times when the British invaded or retreated from the Nagas with the general development of the empire, one can see that the Naga Hills were always in line with the rest of the empire's history. This is very important because most of the authors that write on Naga Hills draw on two historical books written by British officers, of course. They're supposedly only collections of official material, but this material they take, of course, as facts, which they are not, and which those who use these two collections always also have used as facts, which you cannot do. So that is why it came that the Nagas were blamed for their own conquest, but the British, because it was always claimed that they raided the plains, that they raided the plains in ever higher, in greater numbers and more often and so on. And when one then compares the communications of the officers, one can see that this was not true. So that's going to be one example, and this is how I have done primary organization of the book. I then try to generalize the social agents. I said, okay, they are the British, and they are the Nagas, and then I try to make sense out of the British in the first chapter, and when they first came into contact, and in the next chapter I try to make sense of the Nagas, and then I did that through these eight chapters. The first four chapters was always the more powerful that somehow had the initiative, that were British and then the Nagas, and then from chapters 5, 6, 7, 8 was the Indians and the Nagas. Always the more powerful one first, and then the less powerful Nagas second. After I had done that, I realized that Sumit Sarkar had done that in his work while in India too, but back then, of course, with the British and the Indians.
So, could you actually tell us something about British engagement with the Nagas?
The history of the British in the Naga Hills is always a history which is romanticized, as it is often in colonial and imperial history, and also by romanticizing and covered up, one can say, by the production of Wallin's anthropological work, the Nagas, after they had been defeated and posed no danger anymore to the British, became something of an object of admiration or of strong interest to the British. And they wrote Hutton and Mills and someone else, I don't remember the name now, they wrote important anthropological books about them. But the initial contact between British and Nagas, the initial contact was one between equals. When the British in the beginning, because of wars with the Burmans, met the Nagas, they saw them as potential allies, and not as evil, and not as savages. Only when the mountain chain, the Naga Hills, became interesting for the British as a kind of natural line of defense against the potential rival force in the China, the Nagas became enemies and savages suddenly. With the interest of the British, the picture of the Nagas from former potential and completely reasonable allies, they turned into irrational savages. And then the British, when they took away land, which formerly had been under Naga influence, and when they attacked the Nagas, they proceeded in what is called punitive expeditions, what back then had been called punitive expeditions, and which at certain times was also deplored or had been deplored by the center in London, that they destroyed villages and often either killed whole populations themselves or left them to hostile neighbors to be killed. So it was nothing gentlemanlike about that. And during their partial, it was always partial of them, during their occupation, the Naga Hills, because of all the diseases the British brought in, and because of all the forced labor they put on the Naga Hills themselves, and also, and because we only have the descriptions of the British officers, in the descriptions of the officers on the spot, became a desolate zone of diseases, of poverty, and of lack of self-esteem of the people there themselves. And maybe because there's another myth, so it was always the Indian government and the Indian authors and in their succession of political science one, they always claimed that the British wanted the Nagas to be independent after the transfer of power. This was never the case. It has never been the case. They wanted to have some safeguards for them. They wanted to speak for the Nagas, but they never wanted them to be independent or even to speak for themselves. So there, the British imperialists and the new Indian masters, they were agreeing to that. But this one can very clearly see when reading the communications one can find in the British Library on handwritten papers, that there was never one moment when the British wanted the Nagas to be independent again, although some of the soldiers that had fought in the Naga Hills during the Second World War, and the decisive battles in the second, that there had been fought in the Nagas, that allegedly the British promised the Nagas for some support independent after the war, which never was fulfilled, of course.
So how did the Nagas react to, changing British policies towards them and not to successive, like, you know, British governments.
Yeah, could you repeat that, please?
Yeah, sure, definitely. It's how did the Nagas, like, react to, you know, changing British policies towards them, you know, from initial contact to the time, you know, of the establishment of a firmer British administration in the hills, you know, and to successive, you know, to professors, successive governments. Basically, what was the Naga reaction in terms of their engagement with the British?
In the beginning, they resisted the British after Ross's way. But then the Nagas, because they were, as Renato Ronaldo had described, on the Ilongot, because they were politically free, they did not sacrifice people in battle. So when they saw that the British were stronger, they somehow tried to appease them or accommodate themselves with them. But because in the beginning they believed that they would leave again, because there was never anyone before had tried to stay in the hills. So in the beginning, the first reaction was resistance, fierce resistance, then appeasement and promises of good conduct. And when they realized that they wouldn't leave the British, then again resistance. After the Nagas were defeated completely, and there were in the 40s, and then again at the end of the 1840s, and then again in the 1870s, there was heavy fighting. And then always on the fringes of the area that had been administrated by the British, there was also heavy fighting. But the British, because they had no real interest in the Naga hills themselves, but a strategic one, they, and because of the doctrine, the theory of empire, of racism and superiority, the Nagas had to remain different. And because they wanted to have a cheap administration, the British had a very rather light administration, which gave the Nagas the possibility somehow to accommodate themselves with the administration. And as you can imagine, there were most of the Nagas never saw some British or any British, and many of the Nagas maybe were not even aware of the British presence. Mm-hmm. And then coming back to the other thing I said before, British officers always warned not to impose too much forced labor on the Nagas, not to, because the Nagas openly said, if you force us to do that, we will resist, we will fight again. And the British government was always afraid of fighting too much because it was simply too expensive. So due to this relatively light administration, which outlawing headhunting, of course, building down defense structures, which left the Nagas partially to themselves over a long period, which only came slowly, and one didn't know the end or what the outcome. So the Nagas, we shouldn't make the mistake to think they knew what we are knowing now. So they never knew what was happening. They never thought they would stay. And they were always thinking, they will soon leave, because no one else wanted ever to stay. Plus, the practice of imperialism back then had been more acceptable than it is today.
So, and you also mentioned, I think early on in the introduction, that colonialism as such was inconsequential in terms of, you know, its impact on the lifestyle, I guess, for the mass of the Nagas, who were only sensitized to their elite concerns by the Second World War. So, could you tell us something about the impact of the Second World War on, you know, British Naga relations?
Yeah, so as I said, the light administration of colonial rule didn't create any other to create another nation against, or did not create the impact for the normal Naga to now say, okay, now we should mobilize and follow our leaders and so on, because the outside world was still not seen as very consequential. Although during the First World War, several thousand Nagas, also from the non-administrated area, or maybe especially from the non-administrated area, had been as labor corps on the battlefields of Europe. But when the Second World War came to the Naga hills, the Allies, the Americans, especially the British, they really opened up the northeast Naga. As you know, first the refugees came when the Burmese suddenly appeared in Burma. Then the British Expeditionary Corps, the Indian Army in the service of the British, and other refugees flooded through the Naga hills and plundered the Naga villages, according to the sources. Then the Japanese came, and on the other side, the Americans were pushing communication lines to the Naga hills, building also close to Imphal an airfield and flying in massive material and with hundreds of flights per day. So this changed, and the fierce fighting in the aftermath, this changed, of course, that now the Naga saw what the outside world was able to do. So now, that is according to the authors. Now, maybe we can imagine that this is true. Now, the Nagas were open to the few of their political leaders to mobilize themselves, because now everything has changed. One had to organize, or could not stay alone. One had to organize in a nation to defend oneself against the outside world. That was the impact of the Second World War more than the time of colonialism.
Obviously, after the Second World War, the next big event was the British withdrawal from the subcontinent. So what effect did this have on the Nagas?
For the Nagas, for the Naga elite, there was a certain disillusion because they must have read Neil. And still even 1944, Neil said that there are certain areas that did formerly, obviously, did not belong to any Indian state, where after a time of 10 years, interim period of 10 years, allowed to leave the Indian Union. And that is why they proposed themselves that. They said, okay, we will have a 10 years interim period, and then we will see whether we leave the Union. And then they got all kind of contradicting signals, and in the end they realized that all the safeguards, all the promises, all the interim periods, that was not true, that they had no say, and that the Indians first were decided to keep the Naga hills and were decided to decide for the Nagas and not that the Nagas decide. But in the very beginning of the transfer of power, after the transfer of power, nothing much had changed. It needed through some years until the administrators and the armed personnel that must have been around 1950 came into the Naga hills, and then an effective contact with would-be administrators and rulers was starting for all the Nagas, and with that, then the resistance. Mm-hmm. And because, as it has happened in the whole of the post-colonial world, the new masters now behave worse often than the old masters. They have been suppressed before, or oppressed and looked down now. They wanted to look down on others, and they did that. And this, of course, that hit back. What Schiller has said, the bent trick of nationalism hits back. And the Nagas resisted. First, they took the example of Gandhi's non-violent non-cooperation. And then, because the then in charge, the Assamese administration, the charge, answered with violence. They wanted to intimidate the Nagas with a tough policy, with force. Then the Nagas answered, organized themselves, and did it back. Which in the end, despite several approaches from the side of the Nagas, despite several requests for peace or new configuration, which then resulted in Nehru sending the army in 1953, after he had been humiliated by the Nagas when he visited the Nagas. It gave the army a free hand, which made the situation worse. This is again in line with so many other post-colonial countries like Burma, what happened there after decolonization, Indonesia, etc.
You actually mentioned the existence of a political Indo-Assamese elite. So the point here is that it wasn't like, you know, just the Nagas in the region who were resisting the Indian state. It was also like, you know, the other groups in the northeast. So how did the Nagas actually relate to these groups, you know, the Khasis, the Mizos, I mean, the Manipuris?
Yeah, I think I haven't quite understood now the real question. I mentioned the Indo-Assamese elite.
Yeah. I was just wondering, like, the Naga, like, resistance to, like, you know, mainstream Indian rule, that was, like, just one of the many independence or, like, you know, freedom movements that was going on in the Northeast. But there were others, like, you know, the Mizos, the Khasis, the Manipuris. So how did, like, the Nagas actually coexist with these other groups, you know, because these groups were also fighting for, you know, fighting to break away from the Indian state. So what was the relationship between all these other groups in the Northeast and the Nagas?
At the moment, I actually don't know. I think they are in a rivalry now. They are all kind of rivalries. But at the moment, I don't know. I know that in the 60s, Galbraith, the ambassador of Kennedy, he had traveled the Northeast because of the threat of the Chinese invasion, and he already sent a communication to Kennedy to say that there are, next to the Nagas, quite a lot of groups that seriously want to get out of the Indian Union. And back then, as you mentioned, it started in among the Khasis, among the Manipuris, etc. But at the moment, I think the whole Northeast, and that was the last thing I read, is so much in rivalry with each other that no single group could reach a solution at the center. And I think this is a deliberate outcome of the policy of divide and rule, protracting a conflict, of co-opting a single person's into power and confidence, that is sometimes celebrated in the political science literature as a good way of resolving conflicts.
So, I mean, you were just talking about the immediate post-independence policy of the Indian state, but you devote a lot of space to post-Nehruvian policies towards the Northeast, you know, and towards the Nagas. Could you tell us something about those?
Yeah, post-Nehruvian. Nehru, to give him credit, in the very end, he may have been willing to negotiate something more substantial. But then, in the post-Nehruvian era, the Indian state, after it had, there was a ceasefire negotiated in 1964, and then, the the Indians had a lot of other areas of conflict with Pakistan, the other conflicts in the Northeast, in the aftermath of the Chinese invasion. And then slowly, when India had rebuilt its army and strength, it started again an aggressive policy towards the Nagar Hills, which then ended with, with the Shillong Accord, or let's say a kind of a rather, maybe the Nagar resistance had been pretty much beaten until it regrouped to the NSCN, and then the NSCN. So it was a policy of force until the end of the 1997. So it didn't change the policy.
So would you say that the NSCN has always been the main organization spearheading, like, you know, the Naga engagement with the Indian state?
There had been so, but at the moment, I think what I could see in the end was that the NSCN was the Nagas were maybe not satisfied with the NSCN, and there were always groups like inside the Nagas who said, it's Changkul, so certain tribes are dominating the NSCN. But at the same time, what I could realize in the end is that next to the NSCN, besides the NSCN, kind of civil society was growing. That demanded from the NSCN, but also from the Indian side, to respect more the human rights. This is what one can witness when one reads the reports from the Northeast. And I asked some Nagas, and they were saying, yes, as students, mothers, women organizations were gaining in force and strength, and therewith forcing these armed parties more to respect certain rules.
You mentioned that you traveled to Bangkok to talk to some of the NSCN representatives. How was the experience?
Well, the experience was that I could talk for nearly 2 weeks with Weaver, back then I think he was the general secretary of the NSCN, and got via his personal history of the Naga Hills, his view of the Naga history, and he made on me, he made the impression of someone who's seriously concerned about the Naga Naga Nation or the future prospects of life in the Naga Hills. But now, I think what I know now is they have come to an accord with the Indian government, and so there's a substantial ceasefire. For me, I can say that for me, more important is when I talked to, I had these long conversations with the late Mr. Yong Kong in London for more than a year, who had supported Piso, the father of the Naga Nation. And always in his, after a while, we talked about other things, always the main mood was somehow, there's one people that somehow has been dropped or simply of his right to self-determination in waiting. So this is for me an impression more lasting than these 2 weeks in Bangkok. Yeah.
Yes, so going back to the book, there's obviously been a lot of warfare, I mean, and there's been a lot of turbulence. So what sort of impact has all this had on, you know, Naga self-identity, on lifestyles, on patterns of living and family life?
Well, I think that the most important thing is that economically, that the social fabric is destroyed. People have no hope to find decent work or a peaceful, to lead a peaceful life, which drives them maybe to themselves one or the other faction, or to earn their money in drugs trafficking. And so, like the whole of the Northeast gives the impression, due to these conflicts and wars, that it is a low-level war zone in which decent life is rather difficult to be led. And I want to stress that I think in the center, in the power centers of Delhi, the West, one willingly accepts this as a price to the fact that the North is remaining.
We had actually discussed James Scott. I mean, he talks about the northeast of India, upland Southeast Asia, as being a sort of zone where the state does not really, you know, impinge upon the lives of the people, that they prefer to stay out of contact of what we understand as formal state structures. So would you say that is actually true in the case of the Nagas in general, I mean, and the Indian Northeast as such?
I think one has missed a big chance by not respecting their, or a big fruitful opportunity not to find out and respect local forms of government and integrate them maybe into a self-determined zone in which these people could rule themselves, and in which maybe examples and models existed that could be also a model for other areas in the world, to how to organize democracy or whatever we understand with that. I mean, so I think there we have, this is one of the tasks maybe for historical anthropologists, to find out these ways of coexistence or existence without central rule, or with as much democracy as possible. And that is what I thought and read in the old sources. The British in the beginning, they complained about the total democracy which was waning in these hills, and that this was not good. One should impose an authoritarian, a good government. Nowadays they invade countries to give them democracy. So you see, there have been a whole world of alternative ways of life, also in the political sense, had been destroyed. And this is also a shame.
So would you say that your future research would explore some of these aspects? What do you see yourself working on?
Well, my future research, what I can do, what I want to do, is to focus on those elites that have undertake this conquest, which in the end produced all the war and the misery, and to try to understand them. Because I think there is a continuity. I mean, there are, you know, the British behaved in the way like the Indians later on behaved. There's no big difference between the British and the Indians. And when I asked here my government, or my foreign service, they pretty much support the Indian standpoint. So they are the same. When I go to academic conferences or read the academic books, they take the sides of power as well. So here is what that is, because I think like that I relate, I show what has happened in the Narva Hills has also a potential threat for us here. We see that in Europe with the loss of democratic practice in the last 30 years. Actually, we had only maybe 30 years of something which could be described as democracy nowadays. We're losing that. In India, you can see what Burke had said about the British Empire, that if you behave at the periphery like that, it'll come back. And in India, you see that the Naxalites, or when you see this, a large part of the population is not treated as human beings.
Yeah.
And so there is no difference to the market. And
yeah.
I try to understand why someone, I mean, that maybe sounds naive, but that is the question that posed myself. Why does someone want to tell other people what to do? And I use, maybe I can, I've as a starting point, theoretically, I use the critical theory in Frankfurt School, and Otto Horkheimer.
Well, that was fascinating, and I mean, that's actually very insightful, but I'm afraid we've taken up a lot of your time. But one final question before I let you go. I mean, what do you think the future holds for Nagaland?
I think it will be more misery and despair. They will be, because they are so powerless, they will be neglected and dissolved, and they will end up like so many peripheral zones in the post-colonial world. They either migrate somewhere else, or there won't be a decent life. That is, I think there is not much good.
Yeah, that is actually a depressing note on which to end an interview. But in this case, I'd be inclined to agree with you, yeah, that you are right about this, because I don't really see, I mean, that much progress being made, I mean, in respect to the Northeast.
Yeah. One can see that in other areas of the world too. The peripheral areas will be exploited, and that's it.
Anyway, I think we should just hope for the best, and thanks very much for giving your time to the New Books Network, and it's been a pleasure having you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Nara, for giving this opportunity.
Soapbox. That was a facet of South Asia that not many know about. It is not just in the pages of Kipling that people think Darjeeling is a port on the Bengal Ocean. Come up into the hills and pay the Northeast a visit. You will not be disappointed. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Goodbye.